Welcome to The Created Life. Each week, The Created Life podcast offers insightful, inspiring interviews with entrepreneurs, creatives, and people just like you about being empowered, living with vitality, and creating positive change in the world through creative action. The Created Life covers a wide range of topics relating to personal growth, adventure, inspiration, business, social impact, fitness, and health. My name is Damian Taggart. I'm a serial social impact entrepreneur, and I'll be your host on this journey. Thanks for joining me for this episode of The Created Life. On this week's show, I discuss a wide variety of topics relating to sex, pornography, and sexuality with a couple of Denver-based independent art porn producers, Kestrel Mills and Christopher McGill. The content of the show is not overtly pornographic, but we discuss many aspects of pornography as an industry, as well as human sexuality. So please use your discretion if you are listening to this with children present. This week's episode of The Created Life covers topics that I am passionate about and that are extremely important for us to be discussing as a culture, but they are definitely topics suited for a mature audience. With that preface, we cover a whole bunch of interesting aspects of sexual expression in today's episode, including erotic art, using machine learning to create animated erotica, the importance of consent, the state of VR in porn, shame in sexuality, polyamory and ethical non-monogamy, the problems with porn, destigmatizing sexuality, elevating sex out of the gutter, the Tumblr takedown, and more. Today, I'm here with my good friends from Unicorn Palace, Christopher and Kestrel. Thanks for being here today. Do you want to just start with a quick kind of like recap or short kind of encapsulation of the work you've been doing so far and kind of where you're thinking about taking it?
Yeah, for sure. Thanks. Thanks very much for
having us here. Happy to be here.
Do you want to?
Sure. Okay. So we've been making erotic art for almost 3 years now. And so that includes writing erotic poems and fiction, as well as making videos and doing photo shoots. One of our most original or unique products is what we're calling Deep Style Video, which is artificial intelligence trained on models to add the style of a piece of art to video. So we end up with this really cool sort of psychedelic moving painting looking erotic art.
It's a new machine learning technology that came out a couple years ago. It's open source. And yeah, it basically is a kind of automatic animation that's really psychedelic and weird.
Is that the Deep Dream algorithm, or is it similar to that algorithm, the Google?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So Google's ImageNet entry was about image recognition, and then people started basically running it backwards and getting these deep dreamed images. But those were still using the original database of thousands or tens of thousands of images, including a lot of dogs and cats.
Like the weird faces with like 10 dogs or whatever, like psychedelic.
Exactly. Yeah.
So this you guys
is
have
a
taken...
descendant of that, basically, that you just train with one piece of art. Mm. So instead of getting a bunch of dogs, you get a style that's like the piece of art that you gave it.
Oh, really cool. That's awesome. So, and just so our listeners can kind of visualize what this kind of results in. So you guys are doing like pornography, erotica. What term do you prefer?
Amateur porn. Yeah.
And you're running it through different processing through this this algorithmic processing.
Right.
And it comes out with a really kind of psychedelic, artful result.
Right. So you can imagine like Google's Starry Night being applied to every frame of a video. So you wind up with something like that, or Clint's the Kiss, or we use a lot of different styles.
Cool, and we can share a link out in the comments on the podcast or something for people to check it out.
For sure, it's really really unique and like looks really different than anything you've probably seen before.
Cool. So that's one piece of what you've been doing. What else is Unicorn Palace, and what has Unicorn Palace been so far, I guess?
what it's been so far, I mean, it's been an art project more than anything else. And it's also been, I guess, an aspiration to do a bunch of different things. So we're some of the first ones to be using this deep styling technology. And we've talked a lot about doing something in VR once there's a bigger market for that. So a kind of social media community that does erotic art in virtual reality.
Oh, that's awesome. So what is the, like, what would the, I mean, I don't have any idea how people would create their own VR art. Is that like a complex process as it stands today?
Yeah, as it stands today, it's sort of not possible. Okay. So you can see 360 video channels with one camera. 360 video is sort of like VR, but it's really not there yet. And then from the user side, you're kind of wearing this big clunky headset that puts you in it. So in terms of what we're dreaming about doing, it's not possible yet, but we're thinking within about 3 to 4 years, a lot of people will start to be replacing their handheld phones with glasses and the technology to record in 3D a room that you're sitting in will be there.
That sounds awesome. I'm ready.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
I'm totally ready for that. That sounds great to just like be able to have like a heads up display that gives me extra data on what I'm looking at.
Yeah, but so we can have like a physical location, for example, where there's a party, an orgy happening, and people all over the world can tune in and feel like they're there.
That's awesome. So this might be a good segue, or actually, before we move on, is there anything else you wanted to say about kind of where, you know, Unicorn Palace is as an art project now and kind of what you're looking at in the future? Is this, do you want to talk about that now, or do you want to save that for a little later?
The other thing that we're hoping to do with it is to talk about different issues around shame and sexuality, also polyamory, kink, different expressions of sexuality, and talking about them from a first-person perspective, like sharing the details of our relationship, love letters we've written each other, journal entries, emails, just to kind of give people a deep look into what it's like to be in a poly relationship where we're making porn together and have this art project. Cool. We're not interested in having human children, so we have this like art project child that we make together and tend to. And so we're hoping just to like really express ourselves in a radically honest way.
That's really awesome. Yeah, I'd love to like just jump right into some of that, some of those topics. You know, one of the things that I think, you know, the idea of porn can be a very polarizing thing for people. I think people have strong opinions about it. Not everyone. Some people use it as sort of a utility or something like that in their lives. But for a lot of people, there's heavy moral reactions on one side or another. And I think, you know, so it's interesting to talk to people who are using porn as more of an artistic medium, as a medium for expression, and as a medium for really authentically communicating their experience of each other and of life. And so I think there's a lot of things in there that I'd like to get your insights on. One is kind of maybe to start, like, what do you see as like the problems with what we typically think of as porn? Like what are the issues around porn that you guys as, you know, independent porn creators that are trying to do it in a different way, like what are you trying to respond to, I guess?
Yeah. So in my opinion, one of the main problems historically with porn is that it's been made by men, directed by men, funded by men for the eyes of men. And we want to join a growing movement that's making more ethical porn. A lot of times in this historical porn or mainstream porn, the actors, generally, particularly women, often end up feeling exploited or they're taken advantage of, not necessarily doing things that they want to be doing. They're there for a paycheck. And we're hoping to create a community of people who are making porn because they love it and they think it's fun. And if they also make money off that, like, awesome. That's great.
Right. That's cool.
There's also just so little diversity in what you find out there, particularly on the tube sites and free porn, just in terms of body types and the types of sex that you see. It's boring and generally kind of not very real. I think for young people and for diverse populations, it's really pretty harmful. Mm-hmm. Especially if you're not having the conversations with your parents about what sex is. Younger people are really learning about sex from hardcore porn on Pornhub or X videos, which has very little to do with the way that people actually have sex.
Right, totally. And it strikes me as an interesting component to this discussion that one of the reasons why you have such a small amount of diversity in porn is because of the level of stigma that exists around it. So for most people who have maybe it's like the people that go into porn in this mainstream way are probably already kind of fringe actors in some way. They're not like necessarily like mainstream, you know, boys and girls like having normal experiences of growing up or of being young adults or whatever. So I think, you know, it's interesting to try to be a part of this conversation to destigmatize sexuality, to destigmatize expressions and celebrations of our sexuality. And I think that porn could really be a really, you know, useful vehicle to do that. And it's cool to see, you know, people approaching it with that kind of mindset of how do we do this in an ethical way? How do we do this in a way that's respectful? How do we do this in a way that is a celebration of love and connection as opposed to like a denigration or a just really kind of low vibe sort of version of that, you know? So
exactly. And that's all of the people that we perform with, we have a personal connection with. We're not necessarily in love with everyone, but we have love for all of the people that we've performed with. They're friends of ours. And so we definitely want to show that personal connection coming through. We're often talking and joking around in a lot of our videos. We show like when sex doesn't work, like maybe we don't all come, or maybe there's this weird awkward thing, or somebody doesn't like come on them. Like we talk about that and show like not everyone likes to have come all over their face, which is like a very common thing in mainstream porn, have that come shot. So we try to show the sort of behind the scenes also, like we're just regular people, like
to humanize
fun.
It. Yeah,
exactly.
Cool.
Yeah.
And there is a trend to have more feminist porn, producers. There's more and more people out there who are doing really cool stuff, but the porn sites just obviously have the tube sites have a huge head start. So we're trying to, you know, help out the side of good.
Totally. And are there any resources like that you'd want people to know about where you can find interesting like indie porn at this point? Like are there avenues for that already?
Yeah, there are. Tumblr was great and they just got shut down. There was a lot of people curating really interesting content there. I think now it's going to be more about searching out the people that you like that are really making stuff. So two that we watch a lot are Erica Lust, who's she's Swedish, is that right? Or something like that.
She's based in Barcelona now and does a lot of work in Berlin also, filmmaking.
Right, or Dutch maybe, I don't know. But yeah, she's amazing. She makes really cool porn. Four Chambered Heart is one that we used to
They were originally on Patreon. We were supporters of theirs and just recently decided to depart from the platform because officially Patreon doesn't allow adult content and they were afraid of getting shut down and losing their supporters. So they volunteered to leave the platform and go their own way. And we were also thinking to originally have supporters through Patreon, but we didn't want to end up in the same position that they were looking at. So
there are other efforts to kind of create a platform for people making interesting stuff. Like there's makelove.tv. But I don't know. And that's really cool. I don't find a lot of stuff on there that I love.
Is that just because it's too new or is it a different ethos kind of?
I suppose it has to do with their ethos and their curating and their kind of like what they're asking people for. So it's all community generated. I think there is room for people who are trying to bring a little bit more art to their videos.
And like higher production values, or is that what you're saying? So like a professional
So we do kind of semi-professional. Like we're definitely not professional filmmakers. We're not trained in filmmaking, mm-hmm. but we just know some things about making sure the light is good. And
sure. So like, yeah, it'll be a commercial, still could be a commercial endeavor, but have heart to it, have an artistic integrity to it, have all those aspects you talked about. That's cool. Sure. So it seems like, you know, based on what you mentioned with Tumblr being shut down for not safe for work images and video, and then also Patreon kind of banning that content, it seems like despite maybe the prevalence of pornography and its sort of acceptance into our culture, at least in some ways, it still seems like it's a pretty bad time for people wanting to be in this world in a different way. And it's kind of surprising to me that all these mainstream companies have not found a way to kind of bridge that gap a little bit. Does it seem like that's an overall trend that we're seeing right now, that people are maybe more afraid of porn than they were even 5 years ago or something like that?
Yeah, strangely, yeah. Just this past year, there was a new law passed. It's called SESTA-FOSTA. Can't remember exactly what the two acronyms. It was a Senate and a House bill with different acronyms, and the names got stuck together. But it's basically ostensibly about stopping sex trafficking online. But its real effect is to really reduce the ability, especially for sexy people, to speak freely online. Mm.
A lot of sex workers were negatively affected. They were able to find and screen clients online, and now they're sort of pushed back into the shadows. A lot of people are pushed back onto the street, escorts. So it's really impacted their safety. Another thing about Tumblr is that a lot of the curated collections of porn on there were more appealing to women and queer people. And again, so like a lot of the main tube sites are much more heteronormative, mm-hmm. the sort of problems with mainstream porn we've talked about. So it really unequally affected women and queer people.
Yeah, that totally makes sense.
And not just in the last 5 years, but kind of always. It's been difficult for people who make porn to get paid, for independent producers of porn or erotic mm-hmm. art to actually collect money for that. Banks don't want to work with you. A lot of the payment avenues that are open to other businesses just aren't there.
So what, and I don't know if there's an answer to this question or this line of questioning, but like what kinds of cultural changes or changes in the way we think about sexuality and our expression of sexuality would need to occur for us to have maybe a more relaxed and accepting view of things like porn and just sexual expression in general? Like, what do you guys think about that?
I think ideas can spread so quickly these days with online media. It really is just going to take one really good platform that competes with the Pornhubs and the X videos of the world and shows a new generation of people that, you know, sex is really human and includes the whole diversity of human experience.
I love that. Yeah.
And yeah, it doesn't have to be shameful. It's really just everybody does it. And like,
right. It's the reason we're all here.
Yeah. That's where we came from. And it's really pleasurable and fun. And, yeah, I really look forward to the day when, you know, it seems inevitable that young people are learning about sex online. The, you know, more and more school education about sex is being shut down or limited. Parents are often embarrassed to have these conversations. So I would love for there to be a more open and diverse forum for people to learn about sex online.
Totally. I mean, that's a thing that I think about a lot just in general for people, is like this idea of letting go of embarrassment and shame around our bodies, around our sexualities, around just the basic facts of what it is to be human. I think, you know, the fact that we live in a world where we are like literally terrified of like seeing each other naked, like as if, you know, it's like the classic example of, you know, the terrible moment where you're in front of your whole class and you have no clothes on or something like that, you know, or you're
sounds
or,
great.
Yeah, totally. And it's like, So that's a thing that's been, you know, heavily on my mind for the last few years of like, how do we create more opportunities for people to find comfort and find self-love and self-acceptance? Because I think that when we have like a solid foundation of self-love and self-acceptance, including body acceptance and acceptance of our sexualities and our desires, like, you know, that becomes a really solid foundation for all of the other relationships in our lives, whether they're, you know, friendships or business relationships. It's like how you are with yourself is your rock, and everything else is built from that, you know? And so, you know, I really want to see, you know, it's really exciting to see like people doing the work that you're doing and doing it so bravely and talking about these things in a culture that's just like, it needs people to, you know, lead the way. And I think that that's what, you know, the work that you're doing has the potential for. And it's really cool to see. So thank you for, you know, being brave, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Thanks for recognizing that. Yeah. I mean, even after making porn for 3 years, and putting it online, I still run into pieces of shame and embarrassment and feeling like it's not okay that I grew up with, and it's hard to get rid of.
Totally. Yeah, it certainly is. So on this idea of, you know, thinking through this idea of like having a competitive site or a competitive forum for these kind of major porn sites like that people are probably familiar with, when you think about what are the things that would really, you know, what are the distinctions, I guess, between the mainstream pornography and what you're thinking about? Like, do you guys have it already in your mind, like a set of guidelines or like characteristics that create, like, how do you identify, like, this is sort of positive pornography versus, you know, like just thinking about mm-hmm. it from a content curation side, so that if I was going to be a user submitting content to like a platform and I wanted to do it in a more positive way, what do you guys think about guidelines for that? Is that something you've spent time thinking about?
Yeah, for sure. Do you want to?
It's definitely tricky. I think one of the basic things that we want to have be true about the porn is consent. I think consent is a really big topic right now around sexuality in general. But just to know that everybody involved knows what they're getting into, knows what they're going to be doing in front of the camera, and has consented to that ahead of time and feels comfortable with everyone present. I think, you know, I've not been on a mainstream porn set before, but from what I've heard, that's not always true for everyone involved.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's almost always in mainstream porn, at least some level of economic coercion.
I see.
Like people are doing what they're told to do because they need a paycheck rather than because they love it. So I think one thing that we can do is take away the wage exploitation from that workplace. But also, I think in a bigger way, there's a lot of stuff that you'll find on the tube sites that is just kind of icky, that makes you feel bad.
Absolutely.
We were listening to another podcast, Sex Nerd Sandra, interviewing one of the biggest porn curators on Tumblr who just got shut down. Her name was Lady Cheeky.
Yeah, I used to follow her.
Oh, really? Yeah. She said something really cool, which is just, I never had a problem telling the difference. Like, I think there is a lot of bad stuff that you can weed out just by kind of having good values and taking one look.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, totally. It was a little bit of a loaded question on my part because there is this element of, especially when you're talking about art and expression and creativity, where like, there's maybe never like you can't perfectly capture a hard and fast rule that would handle every circumstance, you know, because people as artists especially might want to express all sorts of different feelings or emotions through their work. And I think that you guys have done some of that, of like processing like past sexual trauma stuff through some of your films. And I don't know, is that something that you want to talk about as like a part of your artistic process?
Sure. Well, we actually made a submission to the Hump Festival this year. It was not accepted. We had one accepted last year, but it was pretty close to my heart. It talked about the the shame and trauma that can come from a history of sexual assault and my own process in dealing with that. I worked with a therapist who used EMDR, which I found really helpful. But the other side of things was that I found making porn to actually be really healing in that realm. It allowed me to reclaim my sexual agency, feel really powerful on camera, to look at myself and be like, that's hot, that's beautiful. And to really helped me to sort of move away from that shame and like wanting to hide my sexuality.
And something I think we'd like to do is be really upfront and try to model consensual sex in a way that isn't, you know, you usually don't find. So some of the conversations around sex rather than just the sex acts themselves.
Totally.
And just, yeah, show people how that can be done in a way that's both ethical and also can be really hot.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think the conversation about consent is definitely a larger thing than just, you know, even sexuality. It's like, it's something that I've had to learn a lot about, you know, unfortunately by making mistakes. You know, I realized like I did a lot of things in my life, or I had a lot of behaviors in my life that, you know, I'd like walk into a room and I'd shout somebody's name really loud. And I'd just do things that were like, I thought were fun kind of, or like, you know, from this point of view of like being silly, being like celebratory, or like I'd run in the room and jump on a coworker who's like on the couch or something, you know, just like, or pick people up, or this is kind of like ridiculous behavior. And I realized like, you know, all of those behaviors, what was missing was consent. There was not an element of just like checking in of like, maybe this isn't the like appropriate time to just act in this way. And I think starting to understand that consent operates in this really kind of wide spectrum. It's like a gradient of things. It's even like, why is it, you know, annoying if somebody's on the airplane next to you playing their, you know, own music without headphones on or something like that. Sure, it's like there's, yeah, a lack of consent in that situation. There's a lack of like you're being forced into something. And so I think that's a really great conversation to just extend like throughout all of our interactions with each other, especially as we, you know, more and more humans are living in cities and are closer together than ever, and there's more of us than ever. So it's increasingly an important kind of awareness to have, that there's both a, you know, there's a time for, you know, you can find a way to do all of those kinds of behaviors and to have like all sorts of different sex, but it does all have to come from a place of consent, and it's like a really worthy conversation to be having. So that's cool.
Yeah. I think consent, the word gets a little overburdened with fear at times, and like, we don't know what it means and how do you ask for consent, and there are definitely things that we all need to learn, but I really resonate with your experience of having done a lot of things that are kind of non-consensual, like even just stopping the momentum of somebody else's body by like grabbing them while they're walking or interrupting, mm-hmm, somebody while they're talking. You kind of see it all the time once you start to see it.
Right.
But I think what it really comes down to is just being respectful.
Totally. Like
just having respect for all humans.
Right. And yeah, being able to really see other people's points of view, and yeah, definitely like living in a more expansive way. It's something I've been thinking about a lot too, is just like seeing yourself in other people, you know, and just like really trying to connect to people, trying to deepen your empathy, you know, for anyone. Cause I think it's easy for us to like associate only with our little in-group, whatever, people who look like me or people who listen to the same music that I listen to or whatever. But in realizing that we're mostly the same, even when we're talking about people who are really different from us, you know, like different age, different weight, different cultural background, it's like we still have so much in common, and like coming back to that commonality, you know, is a really easy way to then find those things like respect and kind of connection. And I think, I don't know, that's been a big topic on my mind lately. And I think, it was part of the, you know, it's like the process of hopefully shifting culture towards like embracing things like pornography and sexuality. It's all kind of about, it's a move towards being real. I feel like being honest and like seeing things as they are without judgment, you know? And I think, that's also, I think, the point of like mindfulness and meditation and those kinds of practices, is to like turn off the judging, you know, mind that's like labeling everything, and just be able to appreciate like the beauty of actual reality. And I think sexuality is a huge part of that. It's like a very central aspect to what we all are, and it's weird that we put it into kind of a gutter, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, so I think the work is to like elevate that to its rightful place, because it's such a central thing, like, and it exists all the time. Like, it exists, like, you know, in every situation there's sexual energy, there's like, and it's not scary or bad, or it doesn't have to be scary or bad, it can be just like part of being a living human, you know?
Yeah, it's bizarre, isn't it? Like, it is such a central part of what we do as people, and how we spend our time and what we think about. And somehow we've taken it and put all of this shame and these negative emotions onto sex.
Totally. And maybe, like, what do you guys think about just the idea of polyamory and, like, sort of new relationship models that maybe a lot of people have heard about but haven't experimented with? Or, you know, I don't know. You guys are polyamorous, I'm
guessing. Yeah, yeah. We engage in lots of different relationship models with different people. Each of us have lovers and have had girlfriends and boyfriends over the years that we've been together. We're both bisexual and interested in a wide range of people. I remember when I first learned about what polyamory was, before that, I just thought I was a bad person who, like, always wanted to cheat on people, or, like, looked at other people and wanted to be with them even if I had a partner. And then I learned about this concept. I was like, oh, I think I've just been poly this whole time. Like, the thought of just being with one person just doesn't sit right with me. I have a lot of love to give, a lot of sexual energy, and I like to connect with people in that way. I think it's really special.
That's great.
In the same way that a lot of different types of sex aren't modeled in porn, I think a lot of different types of relationships aren't really well modeled in our culture. So yeah, I felt the same way for a long time. Like, oh, I'm a cheater, because I definitely did kind of go outside relationships and do the bad things back in the day, until I finally realized, oh, that's who I am. Like, I'm not ever going to be dishonest about wanting to be in a monogamous relationship again.
Totally.
Sorry, go ahead.
Just like, there is a way to do that ethically. Like, ethical non-monogamy is another way that people identify themselves as polyamorous. And it takes a lot of effort and a lot of communication. I think in some ways poly is more difficult than monogamy in terms of what it requires of you, and being honest and about your needs and your boundaries, like what's okay. I think it's really beautiful that there's this catch-all term of polyamory or ethical non-monogamy, but really everyone has to write their own rules about what they're comfortable with in their relationship.
I think that's a really good point. It is more difficult to do anything that's not normative, that isn't like sort of the usual thing in our culture. But I also want to put in there, there's nothing wrong with monogamy.
Sure.
Most humans pair bond and want to be monogamous, and that's, you know, you've got to be kind of a weirdo to want to be poly. Yeah, and to do it right.
I think, you know, it's like one of the things that you said that strikes me as really true is like that we don't have, it's like you look at every single Hollywood movie that's ever come out, it's like the same relationship style, basically. It's usually a man and a woman, and like, you know, the story is even the same of like they go through some struggle and then they end up happy and that's it, you know, or like whatever. But it's a very formulaic thing. And then we've got tens of thousands of that story being projected and shown and told in books and all these different, you know, media. And then when you start to think about other kinds of relationships, you know, there's very little out there. You know, there's maybe there's a little bit in terms of, you know, homosexual stories that are told, you know, but even those tend to be monogamous pairs and still like a love story that's very traditional in a lot of ways. So I think that's something that's needed also in the, you know, in our culture. We need to have new stories, tell new stories about different kinds of relationships. And one of the things, like, in my life that, like, you know, I even have a hard time with the term polyamory in some ways, because, like, to me, I think that, like, the way I see it is, like, our whole lives, like every interaction we have with another person is a relationship. As soon as you meet somebody, you form a relationship with that person. That may be it. It might be you buy gas from them and that's the extent of your interaction. But really what forms a relationship in my mind is like how much time you spend together and what the nature of that time is. And like, sometimes it might be formalized in a business contract or a marriage or a, you know, some other kind of formal agreement, but really all of our interactions are a way of relating to each other. And so I think that when we talk about like our really important relationships in our lives, like maybe our relationship to our kids or to our families or to our most significant friend and lover, obviously those relationships have greater weight and greater reality to them. But I see that more as like a consequence of the amount of time that we spend together, the amount of like love that we share, rather than like the contract of like we're in a relationship, if that makes any sense. Like I don't have to, contractually, I'm not in a contract with my children and I still love them deeply. And the relationship is real because of my continued showing up for them and my continued like presence in their lives. And I see that with all the different relationships in my life. So whether it's like a sexual relationship or whether it's a friend relationship, I sort of value those things on the same level. And so for me, there's less of even of a question of like, am I poly? Am I monogamous? It's more just like all of those things to me sound like ways of discussing something, but they're like labels that are kind of after the fact. So I don't know. I have a kind of an unusual take on it maybe, but, because I don't necessarily like the, I think poly can sometimes, for people who don't know about polyamorous life, especially, they can hear that term and just sort of assume that it means you're like fucking everybody and swinging and, just like that you're kind of this sex crazed person, versus it might be that you're 99% of the time you're totally monogamous and in a totally normative relationship. But yeah,
that's true for us, by the way. We're mostly monogamous with occasional, we go and play with other people.
Totally. And I think that's what it's been my experience with a lot of people that I know who are poly. It's like, it's just that there's a little bit more freedom to express and comfort and safety. And the relationship isn't as defined by fear and jealousy and those types of things. It's like, it's more defined by this positive outlook of seeing your partner as a full human being who also has their own sexual drive and has an attraction potentially to other people who are not you, and not feeling diminished by that. And that's something that I think, even if you're in a monogamous relationship, seeing your partner as somebody that has a sex drive and that has like attraction, and that circuitry can exist with other people too. And that's okay. Even if you are monogamous, it's like, not something to be threatened by, it's something to understand and like celebrate as part of your partner, I think. So
yeah, I think that's one reason I really love polyamory, is I feel free to connect with anyone I want in any way that feels good. Like I've had relationships in the past where if I flirted with someone or started to cuddle with them, my partner would get angry and jealous. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I just want to be free to connect deeply with people and like whatever that looks like. And it doesn't mean that jealousy doesn't come up. It does. And I think that's like another beautiful thing about polyamory, is you make an effort to work with your jealousy and talk about it and like feel it and work through it, rather than like, oh, this is a bad feeling, I don't want to go there, let's close things off or whatever.
I think the people that should embrace a poly lifestyle do have some sort of essential difference, which is, well, I'm not sure about this, I'm just throwing it out there. I feel a lot more compersion than I do jealousy. Mm-hmm. So when I think about Kestrel being with someone else, it's hot, I'm like, cool, I hope she feels good. And I think some people are more given to that and some people are more jealous. And totally. If you're a jealous person, then it's fine to be monogamous. But the thing is, like, even in monogamous relationships, having that fear and that inability to deal with jealousy is going to cause strain in the relationship.
Totally.
Like, it's going to happen over the course of a marriage.
Totally. Yeah, and I think that's a good point. I think the point that feeling jealousy isn't something to even be upset about. It's a normal feeling. It's like, I think that we have a misconception generally about feelings, of what feelings are. Like, I think there's a sense of, you know, oh, I'm depressed, and depression is a thing to be avoided. And so there's a sort of failing in being depressed, or I'm having anxiety, and anxiety is a thing to be avoided. And so there's like a sense of, I never want to have anxiety, or I never want to have jealousy. And I think, you know, the insight for me lately has been that actually all of those emotions serve some kind of function. They're like a state that your body gets into. And usually the way out of those emotions isn't through like thinking your way out of it. You don't think your way out of necessarily jealousy or out of anxiety. You get through it. You know, there's different ways to cope with those things. You know, some of them are like physical, like breathing or going for a run or talking things out with your partner or whatever. There's a lot of different ways to kind of be reassured and calm down. But essentially, you're changing your physiology. You're getting back to a place of, you know, lowering the cortisol levels in your blood and, you know, increasing oxygenation. And, you know, so it's like looking at those things as, you know, physiological responses that are connected to the stories that we tell ourselves about our lives, about our relationship. And on that level, like I can speak for myself that, you know, I used to be a much more jealous person. I was raised in a jealous culture, you know, that a culture that basically taught you to be possessive and to be like, the idea of your girlfriend or boyfriend being with somebody else was just like horrible. It was just like horrible idea, you know? And it took me a lot of work as an adult to like unlearn a lot of that. And I think, but so I just want to say that I think it is possible to shift your thinking, even if you start out from a, like, also I was raised extremely like homophobic. I remember having, you know, that was just the values of my family and the values of our religious community and stuff. And I think, having to unlearn that, you know, but then over time you're like, you know, well, some of my best friends are gay, of course. Like, why would I like have, you know, why would I see these people as anything less than, or why would I see them as something to be afraid of? And I think that there's just a lot of, you know, it's like, it can be hard for people who never had to experience like what it's like to be a homophobe or what it's like to be an extremely jealous person to understand and have compassion and patience with people who are. But I think that there's an opportunity to connect to people like who are going through those types of feelings and in some ways like lead by example, like without being like how stupid you are, how wrong you are, you know, like I can't believe you have such primitive values. Like trying to find a way to connect to that and saying, look, I get where you're coming from because I used to be that, or, you know, because it makes sense on all these levels, and starting from that place and then sort of saying, you know, but you don't need to stay that way. And I think that there's a lot of work to do around that. I want to do some like video series specifically about like some of the topics we've talked about, like what I've learned about consent, what I've learned about, you know, not being a homophobe, like, cause I feel like I've got a lot of, personal experience in those areas just from coming from a very kind of right-wing religious background. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I know other people are struggling to connect to themselves, to connect to the world in different ways. And so, yeah, it's definitely on my mind too.
I think that's a really admirable project. I think you're right. It's important to talk about the ways that we have been that we maybe think are not, you know, the way that we intend to be in the future, and really like start from a place of what are our weaknesses that we're trying to get rid of. It seems like you're also kind of talking a little bit about mindfulness, and just bringing more mindfulness even to the really negatively valenced emotions that we feel, and not necessarily reacting automatically and letting those drive our behavior.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, yeah, to kind of finish that thought on the emotion side, I think I was thinking about, you know, I learned a lot about fear doing a lot of mountaineering and like going to high places. I had fear of heights and can kind of continue to put myself into those situations. And one of the things that I had to learn was that like it's okay to have this overwhelming feeling of fear as long as like I keep my mind in a place where I can continue to make choices. I'm still going to take the next step. I'm still going to like reach for the next handhold. And so then you start to build up this awareness that regardless of the power of the emotion that you're having, your executive function is still yours to control. So it's like, I'm angry, but I can still choose how I respond. I'm jealous. I can still choose how I respond. So it's like being in the presence of a powerful emotion, but how are my choices? You know, how am I choosing in this moment? I think about that. It's true for like depression too. It's like you might wake up and be super depressed and not want to get out of bed. But if you can make the choice to get out of bed, even though you feel terrible, you're like in one step closer to like changing your environment enough to change your physiology back to a different way. You know, so that's something that I think about a lot. And it's often easier said than done, and it takes practice to do it. But I think just having the awareness of my emotions aren't in the driver's seat, like, but I'm also not suppressing them. I'm not trying to avoid having these emotions, but I'm going to like, you know, have them, experience them non-judgmentally, and I'm still going to make choices. You know, that's, for me, that's also a connection to this creative process of living a life. Like you're picking up the pen, you know, you're taking control of the story that you're writing of your life. Like, and that's one of the things like I'm trying to like kind of pull out of people in this podcast is like, what kinds of cool things are you putting yourself out there to be the author of, you know, to say like, this is my saga. This is my like impact on the earth while I'm here for this, you know, short, but also long time. So, yeah. So on that, do you want to talk any more about like what your current business plan is around this or not really? Is that kind of still unformed?
It's in the process of being reformed. For the moment, our business plan is a little website with some sexy videos of us. And one thing that's really important and that will stay part of the business plan going forward is that it's all in the gift economy. So there's no paywall on the website. Everything's out there for free. We believe that being generous in that way and generous with ourselves and our lives and the things that are true and real for us will inspire the generosity of others. We need money to pay our rent like anybody else, but we're just doing a pay what you want model.
That's really cool. Can you guys tell me more about the gift economy and like how you see that as a thing that could, you know, what do you think of the gift economy if you like, how could that spread, you know, and touch more people? Like, what do you see in terms of the future of that way of giving and connecting?
So something I think a lot about. Do you want to say anything, or should I?
It's a little bit more your thing, but just to say that what we've found already and what we hope to continue to see is starting from a place of generosity and abundance sort of just creates that and spreads out from there. And just the way the economy is going and AI and technological developments, we're thinking that is going to spread.
So. Yeah, I'm a technology person, very interested in things that are going on, kind of a Church of the Singularity Kurzweil follower. And I think that one of the things that our society is predicated on is this kind of zero-sum mentality of scarcity. And I think just in a few short years, like certainly less than two decades, scarcity is going to be really a thing of the past. It's not about the proletariat grabbing the means of production from the capitalist. It's just the means of production are getting really efficient and really cheap, and we're going to have 3D printers that print at nanoscale in our houses. So owning a factory will not really be an advantage anymore. You know, capitalism is about how to distribute scarce goods in a fair way. And once scarcity is not a thing, we have something else coming. So what does an abundance economy look like? There's something fundamental underneath the value of a dollar, which is just reputation. It represents how much value you've given to the human race, or at least ideally. It's kind of gone a long way from that.
Mm-hmm.
but I think we're going to get back to that. And I think that the way to, I mean, the adaptive strategy in the future is going to be generosity. It's going to be giving as much as you can.
Totally. I think that's really aligned with the way that I'm seeing, like, the future to me is solving problems together. You know, it's like, it's sort of looking at, and it may be a while, but I sort of visualize that if humanity can continue to exist for a long enough period, we're going to eventually have to start solving problems as a globe. You know, like, that's really the future. If we're going to survive, like, it doesn't make sense to just, like, live in these warring tribal bands that we call countries anymore. You know, I think that idea is time limited. It's just like, it's a primitive way. It's like tribal territorial stuff. And I think
it's do or die. I think we've got these global problems mm-hmm. that we can't solve with any national government or even cooperation between national governments that are basically looking at a 4-year time frame in terms of their interests.
Right. And it may be die and then do. Like, maybe there's going to be some big, like, kind of correction, and then we pick up the pieces. But I think, you know, I was thinking the other day, like, that we live in a time where if we have to sometimes ask the question, like, is the government open today? Like, it kind of says everything you need to know about the how relevant the government is. You know, it's like, we're really at a place where I think it's time for us to get creative as people and take sort of responsibility for what we're creating and not continually to, like, I think there has been a historical pressure on us and also impulse to turn over our own individual authority to the authorities, to other people, to, like, whether it's our parents, our school administrators, our government administrators, our elected officials, the police, whoever it is. It's like there's a externalizing of accountability. And I think if we start to take that accountability on ourselves, we start to live in a way that has more integrity, more authenticity, and we ultimately create more power. And with that power, we can become self-governing. We can become, you know, autonomous in new ways that we haven't been before. And once we don't really need to be governed because we're governing ourselves, we're taking care of ourselves, we're taking care of the people around us, we're, like, you know, operating from a standpoint of generosity and abundance and compassion, and, like, within that, self-control, because that's, like, one of the big things. It's like, you know, if you're repressed and you're not getting enough, you end up with this, like, emotional scar tissue that, like, you, when you finally do have some power, you're, like, going to be power hungry, and you like overdo it, you know, because you're coming from, like, a situation where people had hurt you or you didn't have enough. You were coming from scarcity. And I think as a species, like you're saying, we're moving out of that. We're moving out of this, like, time where we only had a dim understanding of what it even meant to be a human and what it meant to be alive on Earth. And there was this constant struggle for survival, which still exists in many parts of the world, I think. But it is a thing that we don't have. It's like, I don't believe that we have to just accept it as that's how things have to be. I think we could obviously, you know, you come together in a different way, use our innovation to create a better world. We just have to start asking ourselves, like, we have to believe, first of all, that it's possible. You know, we have to come from a place of set a higher bar. You know, I think we're kind of, we talk ourselves out of the big vision a lot.
You know? Yeah, I think there's something that you're pointing to, which is there's a kind of a connection between our scarcity mindset and a central authority of one kind or another. So if we don't have much money, and if we've always felt that there's not enough, there's a kind of, like, personal anxiety about that. And we need a government to tell us, no, you have to pay 30% taxes. Mm-hmm. Or we need a church to say, no, you have to tithe 10%. But if we're coming from a place where we're secure and know that there's going to be enough, and that even if we give away 90%, we're still going to have enough. It's easy to do that. Like, then I think the normal human impulse is to make sure that the people around you, and as many people as possible in as wide a circle around you as possible, also have enough.
Totally.
I think we also need to ask ourselves the question, like, what is enough? One thing I love about outdoor adventures, specifically backpacking in my case, is you realize, like, I can be out on the trail for weeks with very little, mm-hmm. and I can still be happy, I can feel fulfilled. I can feel good in my body. I can interact with people around me. So I think in a lot of cases, we actually need a lot less than we think we need in order to be satisfied and live full lives.
Totally. That's been another thing I've been deeply kind of meditating on, of just like, what is actually necessary for happiness and for a full life? And turns out it's like not a lot, you know? Yeah. But one of the things that's definitely there is like, you know, you get your basic needs, obviously, like food, shelter, all that stuff. But then, you know, really high on that list is love. It's connection to others. It's like a place of, it's recognition too. It's like being able to be seen and understood by people. And I think, you know, that's also something that, I don't know, is connected to our sexual politics also, where people have been trained into, have only been offered one context in which to live, and that's like nuclear family kind of setups that can be very isolating, whether it's like an apartment or whether it's a home. And I think that there's a missing piece of just like recognition of your community and being seen by other people in that, and it can be really stressful on a lot of like individuals and parents and stuff. And so I think, yeah, that's also something that I think moving more towards like a communal kind of existence, not like total, you know, I don't want to abandon like having privacy and private, you know, things. I value that just as much as anyone, but just having more points of connection and love and safety.
I want to abandon some private things. I hate that we need our own lawnmowers.
Oh yeah, totally.
Things like that. Like, we need one lawnmower for a block of people. So I don't know. I think Kestrel lived at Twin Oaks Commune for a while, and I got to go visit there and a couple of other communities. And I think there's a lot to be said for that model, just being in proximity to a bunch of people who are basically about sharing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a better way to live.
So we're almost out of time, but I wanted to... So I've been asking everybody I interviewed like for basically what... If there was like one practice or one teaching or one idea that they could leave and spread that idea kind of virally to everybody on the planet. So like, if you could like infect all of humanity with one idea or practice, what would that be? And you guys can each answer.
Well, I think just kind of based on our conversation, this is something that I hold dear, that, connection and community is more important than stuff.
That's great.
And giving generously is a good strategy for taking care of yourself.
That's awesome. Well, thank you guys so much for coming on. It's been really a pleasure to talk to you. I hope I didn't talk too much.
No.
No. This was great. Fun.
Fun conversation. Cool.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for this installment of The Created Life. Thanks to Ryan Fu at the Podspace in Denver for recording our interview. Be sure to tune in next week for my interview with a man that has an amazing story of healing through the grief of losing his entire family. My guest next week is Ted Wired. After Ted moved through his own massive loss, he devoted his life to helping other people do the same thing. Until next time, this is Damian Taggart signing off.